Hey, Jets fans, want $50 off your next round of drinks? Try Tap RM. They deliver the drinks right to your door so you can skip the lines and trips to the liquor store. Discover new and exclusive drinks or shop for your favorites. Don't worry, they've got all the options for you. Order your first round at taprm.com and get $50 off your first order using promo code JETS50. $50 off $100 a beer, not a bad deal. I would highly recommend it. I've done it. Connor's done it. Joe's gotten it. So make sure you go to taprm.com, use promo code JETS50, skip the lines, and get $50 off your first $100 worth of beer. $100 in beer for $50, can't beat that. Now let's get into the pod.
Setting up, looking downfield. He's going to heave a bomb for Corey Davis at the goal line, into the end zone. He's got it! That's a Jet touchdown!
Jets select Zach Wilson, quarterback, BYU.
What's going on, everybody? Welcome back to the Turn the Jets podcast. I'm your host, Will Parkinson, at WillPod11 on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok. Joined by a special guest today, Joe Rivera, Joe Rivera SN on Twitter. Joe, how you doing today?
Well, I'm doing wonderful, friend. How are you?
I'm good.
You know, wonderful's a stretch, but
yeah, I was just say I'm better today than I was yesterday. Leaving MetLife was not a pretty scene. A MetLife that was probably 75% Bills fans, and the most packed I've seen MetLife since week two. So that was not a lot of fun. I feel like we're having a conversation I didn't expect to be having this late in the season with the Jets. Obviously, I didn't think they were beating Buffalo, and I projected 30-13. So it's not like I wasn't that far off, I guess. It's just the manner in which they've been blown out in the games they haven't won. Obviously, the big wins over Tennessee and Cincinnati are great, but they are 2-7, have gotten blown out 4 or 5 times now. So what has your impressions been of yesterday overall, and you know, where the Jets are at 9 weeks into the Robert Saleh era?
Yeah, well, I think so much of there's so much that goes into a conversation about the Jets this year. Like, there's so much nuance. There's so much context you have to put into it. It's just not a matter of these guys are underperforming. It's not a matter of, oh, well, this is just a rookie coach. It's a matter of they do have injuries. And you know that the Carl Lawson injury killed them. The LaMarcus Joyner injury, I think, is that was another injury that really hurt them on the defensive side of the ball. Jamie Sherwood was he was starting to flash a little bit before he got hurt. So there's a ton that goes into it. Obviously, when you talk about that and you discuss that, you also have to take into account the turnovers with Mike White yesterday and 4 bad turnovers that leads to you getting blown out too. So I think this year I had them projected at 5 wins. And I thought the defense was going to be horrendous this year, to be honest with you. I didn't think that they had a whole lot of talent. Surprisingly, I thought that the cornerbacks have been playing better, but when you look at the solid defense and the system that they're trying to run, and so much of that relies on, number one, getting pressure up front, which they haven't really done consistently. Number two, they're really relying on the linebackers to be speedy and really fly to the ball, which they haven't really gotten either. So, I mean, overall, this is kind of the season that I was expecting, to be honest with you. I think that you look at the blowouts and some of its quarterback play, a lot of it is obviously bad defense, but I kind of expected that. Has it been worse, a little bit worse than I expected? I think so, but this is a team. It's growing pains. It's lots of rookie players, lots of rookie defenders, rookie head coach, rookie play callers, all top to bottom. So it sucks. It sucks, but this is just part of the process.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think part of the issue is that you going into the season, everyone's expecting 5-6, you know, optimistic fans, 7-8 wins maybe. And they're still on pace to like probably get to 5 or 6 wins. Realistically, they've got a really soft part of the schedule here coming up, but it's just the manner in which they've been blown out, and like the Adam Gase type of, even actually frankly worse than a lot of the Adam Gase stuff. They've scored points. They're not as anemic on offense. And I think, you know, yesterday obviously stunk. The Bills are the best defense in football. To think that Mike White was going to throw up 300 yards and 3 touchdowns would have been, then I would have actually had a quarterback controversy, because now you're like, all right, this dude's, you know, doing it week after week. There's real stuff here. But who are some guys, I guess, that obviously, again, 2-7, not playing well for the most part. Who are some guys you've been maybe disappointed with, you know, so far this year that you thought would maybe take a bigger step? Corey Davis stands out for me. I've been pretty disappointed. I didn't think he was a 1A, but the drops, the fumbles, it's a little concerning for the price tag he's getting paid.
Yeah, I think Davis has got to be up there, especially the drops early in the season. And it wasn't really a matter of, well, you know, it's a first down pass. He had lots of killer drops in the season early on. And obviously the fumble yesterday on Sunday was brutal too. So Davis stands out to me. You know, outside of that, I think Quinnen Williams has been a little bit of a disappointment. I mean, obviously he's got the 5.5 sacks, but not a lot of that dominance that we saw last year. And you know that the talent is there. You've seen it in the past, especially last year when he really got going middle towards the end of the season. But yeah, it's tough to say because so many of these guys, Denzel Mims is another one. Obviously everybody was clamoring for Denzel Mims, but I think the one thing fans have to keep in mind is they see this guy in practice every day and they saw him in training camp every day and they know what they had. And it's a matter of getting the best players in the best positions. You can't just throw these snaps at players expecting them to improve when they're not showcasing that in practice and in training camp. So I think those are the three guys to me who've really kind of, you're kind of relying on them to be big parts of the offense and for Quinnen, obviously on defense, but it just hasn't been there. It just hasn't been there this year so far.
Yeah, it's weird. Quinnen's production level in terms of actual stats looks great on paper, but I don't feel like I felt his presence in more than like two or three games. And it's not to say he's played badly, but he hasn't taken that year three jump. I thought he would take in this defense. And obviously Carl Lawson being hurt, Bryce Huff's been hurt a bunch. And I understand they're under a man there, but they still should be a talented unit. I know Jake Asman, a friend of both of ours, mentioned today. He's like, this D-line is one of the most overrated position groups in the entire NFL. And while it's felt like a kind of a hot take, you kind of look at it and you go, I'm not sure it's the craziest take in the world based on kind of what's occurred. They just have not gotten pressure. Like the Bills offensive line is not very good. That's one of their Achilles heels. And I felt like yesterday, while they had a little bit of pressure, they're not getting home enough. And for the amount of aggressiveness this team is supposed to have, you got to get to the quarterback or this defense is going to get exposed a little bit. Jared Davis, another guy that comes to mind, is just, I'm not saying I was expecting him to be some superstar, but I know he's a good off the field guy and he's had some good quotes, but it's been ugly. The three or four games he's played, frankly, they looked better with backups in there. An off ball linebacker, and it's a position in need. So I know you've been kind of outspoken on the Mike White thing of being, trying to be realistic about it. And I think, it's hard not to have fun and enjoy what's happened with Mike White. I think it's okay to have rooted for him while he was playing and understand Zach's the guy going forward. And there was never a question. Where do you stand on Mike White, you know, through those three games? And what are your expectations of Zach going forward here with this, you know, 8 or 9 games left to play?
Yeah, I think for me, the whole Mike White saga is going to be really interesting to look back on because it's not like I want to throw the guy in the dumpster. I don't. I think that what he's proven to you and what he's shown, and this should be a positive for Jets fans, is that he can be a viable backup quarterback. He's a guy that's going to get you in a pinch. He's going to give you competent snaps. We saw yesterday, or you saw in the Bills game, that White was, you know, when you're asking him to do a little bit more, it won't go as well. And he was a little bit more inaccurate, especially on the short throws. He was missing guys high and outside. But in a pinch, if you need him, if, you know, God forbid, quarterback one goes down, he's a guy who can be that backup for you. Listen, I have no problem with fans having fun with it. Like, it was a fun story, you know, but it gets to a point where I think this season, more than years past, is you hear people being like legitimately like extremely impatient with what they're seeing this year, which I think is very unfair. And I understand like we're like 10 years now removed from last going to the playoffs and then this whole thing of, well, I'm tired of rebuilding and this and that. That's why I said this conversation really requires nuance, but I never really looked at Mike White as being like a viable guy moving forward. Now with Zach, all you need to see from him is just play like Mike White played in the Bengals games to that end. Just take what the defense gives you. And you're seeing a lot that these guys are getting open underneath. And Zach, I think feels pressure to play hero ball a lot of the time. And really look for the big play first before, you know, maybe the smart play. So hopefully sitting out these few games, he'll come back and he'll really, you know, settle down and just take the easy throws. When you look at some of his pass breakdowns too, he's really struggling most to his right throwing short. His left throwing short, not as much, and it makes sense mechanically. Maybe he opens up a little bit more throwing to his right side. So I'm not too concerned with the short accuracy because for me personally, I'd rather have a quarterback who's accurate deep because you could at least fix the short stuff. And we've seen that with Josh Allen over the last, you know, 3 years, which is why Salah kind of brought up that comparison. But I just want to see Zach just take the easy stuff. I want to see him just settle down, just play within the system like they asked him to do, playing boring football. I think that's fine. And if defense comes around, you know, you hope they play better than what they've shown the rest of the season. But if they do come around and Zach can keep you in games, that's, I think that's all you can ask for the rest of the season.
Yeah, it's interesting. I did a little bit of a breakdown on that as well on Twitter, just the way he, to the right side, just his mechanics have been awful, frankly. And it's like he lost all of that. And then the left side, it's the same exact throw to the other side of the field. And it's like pinpoint accuracy. So it'll be interesting to see when, you know, when he comes back, how he kind of mentally digested everything as well. Felt like the game was a little too fast at times for him. And he was kind of scrambling, second guessing himself. Naturally, as rookie quarterbacks do, we've seen it with everybody. Trevor Lawrence not lit the world on fire. Justin Fields has had moments, but also, frankly, is the worst QBR in football. And, you know, you go on and on. And, you know, as good as Mac Jones has looked at points, Mac's turned the ball over a bunch for an offense that is meant to not turn the ball over. So all these guys have struggled a little bit. Trey Lance can't get on the field, which is a whole nother discussion for another podcast. But yesterday there was a lot of criticism of Saleh. There's been a lot of criticism outwardly in the media. Frankly, guys who, and this is not at Rex, there's other people on GetUp who I'm not going to name that get very love to be outspoken when things go wrong, and not kind of, and you know, make some outlandish takes. Rex obviously was very harsh. He's been harsh on Saleh a bunch this year, and I'm not really sure why. It doesn't really make sense to me. I feel like it's a weird kind of guy to go at. He did say some really intense stuff, and I'm not saying any of it was wrong or right, but what did you make of Rex's comments and then Saleh kind of firing back and being like, dude, I don't know you and you know where to find me. I'm not sure what your problem is.
Yeah, I think Rex, and you've seen this for a few years now, he really comes off like the crazy ex-girlfriend. That's really what it comes down to. Like, I do like he was given a very long leash, and let's not forget when Rex came in and he took those teams over those, you know, Eric Mangini built teams, and he took them to the next level. And that's fine. It's fine to admit that he did that. But then you have the Quentin Copels of the world and the Calvin Pryors of the world who come in after that, and the Sheldon Richardson of the world and the D Milliners who just don't work out. And not to say that Rex was the guy drafting those guys, because obviously Tannenbaum and Idzik had a lot to play in that. But I think that his legacy is a little bit overstated, to be honest, especially when it comes to the Jets. Like, it's not a guy who he was here for 8 years, and each of the 8 years they were in contention. It was just diminishing returns. So, you know, as far as Saleh goes, I like the way he handled it. I mean, I hate when coaches just in general, and it's not just because I'm in the media and I like the fodder, but I hate when coaches kind of say, well, I didn't hear that. I didn't listen to it. I didn't pay attention to it. Saleh's being very upfront, and the way Rex came off, it did come off very personal for some reason. I don't know why that is. It's very strange, very strong the way he said it. We know Rex has always been an outspoken guy, but to kind of come at Saleh for that and to say that a team has no heart when you're not there in the locker room, that's a tough pill for me to swallow. It really is. So hopefully this squashes it. I mean, who knows with Rex, he'll go on GetUp tomorrow and they'll just churn out another story because that's what they do. But hopefully it's the end of it for now.
Yeah, I thought Saleh handled it well. The Rex stuff is just weird because it's been like, it's not just once. It happened after after the New England game. It's happened a couple of times where it's felt like, I don't know what the beef is. And, you know, obviously Rex is a prideful guy, and I totally understand that. And they've got compared to each other that, you know, Rex even mentioned it. Saleh was like the less bravado kind of Rex and outspoken. But to say he's not a good defensive coordinator, and I kind of went on a little bit of a rant earlier about this, that all of a sudden Saleh was now a bad hire and he didn't know what he was doing. I mean, the guy was one of the top three or four most well-regarded defensive coordinators in football going into this offseason. And, you know, you can't go back and be like, oh, now he wasn't good. And that's the stuff that I can't stand. Mekhi Becton today, another story. Obviously, he's, you know, not going to be practicing for a few weeks still. Saleh said between 1 to 3 weeks, he'll get back in the field. Not leg is not, as Saleh phrased it, which is not the way it was spun, but Mekhi will, you know, is not ready physically to be practicing in terms of strength in the knee and mobility and kind of just his overall shape. It's not to say that Mekhi is fat or out of shape, which is what it was told. Obviously, he's 360 pounds and he's coming back from a pretty serious knee injury. Do you think we see Mekhi play at all the rest of the year? Because it's feeling like this is going to get to the point where it's week 14, 15, 16, and what's the point of getting him out there?
Yeah, I mean, I would like to see Mekhi back on the field just so he can get those reps for AVT alongside Vera Tucker. I really do think that matters a lot for an offensive line, and you don't want to go into next season and really have to work on their chemistry. So I would like to see him back on the field. And there was a certain tweet that was out there. I just want to say there was a certain tweet that was out there. I won't name from who, but it certainly did sound like he was trying to bait people into saying Mekhi's fat, you know, which we saw a video of Mekhi on the field. Rich Cimini had tweeted it, I think on November 10th, and he looked like Mekhi. Like, he didn't look like he was, you know, scarfing down triple cheeseburgers from McDonald's or whatever. He just, Mekhi's a big dude. Like, he's 6'7". He's an offensive lineman. Like, he's always going to be naturally big. And a guy who's that big is usually going to take a little bit longer in his rehab for that very reason. It's going to take time for him to get back on his feet. So I would like to see him. We are getting to the point where you have to ask yourself, is it worth it? But I would like to, and to be fair, George Fant has played very well in Mekhi's stead. Surprisingly well, to be honest with you, but I would like to see him. I definitely would like to see him back on the field this season, even if it's for a 3-game stretch.
Yeah, no, I think the reps and the run game has definitely suffered from not having Mekhi out there. I think while Fant's done well in pass pro, he's not a great run blocker. He never has been. Mm-hmm. I don't think the Jets would expect him to be, which is why it's definitely concerning the play from center and right guard. You know, regardless of what the PFF stats say, it's been ugly on that right side, other than Morgan Moses. And I would love to see Morgan Moses back here 100%. But, you know, we'll see on that. Two other positives from yesterday that continue to be positives, Michael Carter and Elijah Moore. You know, a bunch of this draft class, frankly, outside of obviously Zach's an unknown, but AVT has looked really good a majority of the year. Michael Carter has been really good, effective in the passing and the running game. Elijah Moore, obviously, I think he's got 4 touchdowns in the last 4 games. How impressed have you been with those two, and where would you like to see them kind of improve over the last 8 games, you know, here before going into year 2?
No, I think it's their rookies, right? I mean, that's number one. And again, conversations with the Jets require nuance. Michael Carter is going to look like a guy who's a rookie. Michael Carter, the second, Michael Carter, the first, I guess, the running back he's a guy who's certainly shown more and more as the season has gone on. And you'll love to see that. You know, for me and Elijah Moore, even in a blowout, there's things that you can always analyze in a blowout, and you can always break down a blowout, like regardless of the score. The fact that Moore was getting open the first part of the season, but I like to see the growth from Mike LaFleur and actually getting him the ball more, which is nice, and more design touches for him because he can really be that guy. And coming out of college, his tape looked a lot like Antonio Brown. It's just his route running is precise. It's crisp. It's there. And is what he does with the ball in his hands after the catch is really something special too. So, you know, it's tough to say where they can improve, because I think especially with wide receiver, it's so quarterback dependent, right? It's probably the most symbiotic relationship on the field. So it's tough to see where he can improve. I think, you know, Michael Carter, the running back, I don't want to say he's a finished product, but he certainly looks that way right now. This guy, like the doctor tried to, you know, at birth that he slipped through the doctor's hands, because he's that first contact, like it's just natural to him. It's crazy. So, and Michael Carter, the defensive back, Michael Carter, the second, he's been everything that you could really ask for out of a mid round pick, especially for a slot guy. So, obviously they're going to look like rookies the rest of the way too. I think Michael Carter II's hit a wall a little bit the last couple of weeks. We'll see how he rebounds the rest of the way, but on a broader scale, on a grander scale, you should feel really, Jets fans should be very encouraged with this draft class and with Joe Douglas and what he did. So I know that he's kind of been drawing the ire of a lot of fans, but this is the foundational class right now. It really is. So we'll see how else he can build the team this offseason.
Yeah, because the 2020 draft class is struggling, to say the least. I'm not quite as down on Ashton Davis overall as everybody else is. I just think you have to have patience. Safety is an incredibly difficult position. He's playing with guys who I don't think he intended. You know, the Jets had foreseen him playing next to Marcus May. Injuries, his eyes have been kind of all over the place. He makes impact plays and then gets burned. So, you know, we'll see kind of how this all plays out. This week coming up, Miami. Tua is going to be starting for the Dolphins back at, you know, this back and forth of the Brissett and Tua train, which is always interesting. This on paper is a winnable game for the Jets. Even going into the year, this was a game that the Jets probably had to win to get to that, you know, 6-win mark.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called Pi, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcast, homecast.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon slash spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an eight-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
Do you think they're able to get it done and we'll see a revamped kind of, hunger and desire from this team? Or is it going to be, could it be another week of Jets fans leaving MetLife not too happy?
I had this as one of the five games that I had them winning this year. I'm pretty sure I did at least. But, you know, for me, Tua's, for however good he's been, Tua's been pretty good this year. I know, injuries aside, he hasn't been awful. He is going to give you opportunities, though. Like, he's going to make the boneheaded throw. He's going to make a pass where you're like trying to figure out where he was trying to fit a ball, and then, you know, it just wasn't there, whatever you're trying to see. So Miami's defense has played better as of late, which is encouraging for them. I do think that the Jets, there's just something about this team where, you know, they get smacked, they get punched in the mouth, and then they come out and then they, you know, they get punched in the mouth again. And we've seen it seven times this year, but I still think they have wins in this roster. I think there are wins in this team. And I do think that they can beat Miami, especially at home. So Miami just doesn't scare me offensively. I know Gesicki's been good. Like we mentioned, Tua has been pretty good, but they just, as a team as a whole, they don't scare me this year. They've really underachieved. I understand that some of it is, maybe they overachieved last year, so expectations were different, but I think they can be had. I really do. I really think that this is a game that the Jets should bounce back from, at least play competitive in, but I do think that they can get a win this weekend.
Yeah. I mean, the Dolphins offensive line is one of the worst offensive lines I've frankly ever seen. It's really bad. And if they are in the Jets D line, this, healthy or not, guys like Quinnen Williams, as we mentioned, John Franklin Myers, to get out of that rut a little bit. They need to make plays on Sunday to give the Jets a chance. Like you said, Tua will gift you a few. The Dolphins play a ton of man coverage. It's going to be a big test for these receivers. Like, can you get open? Zach Wilson, if he's playing, which I would be really surprised if Zach doesn't play. I think the Jets are kind of taking that coy, cautious approach to say, oh, Wednesday we'll see. But this will be, week four of an injury, and you're not rushing him back at this point unless he really isn't clearly healthy. But if you practiced all week last week, it would be very weird. And if Mike White, after getting injured for the third straight time, in three starts. Wanted to transition quickly. We'll finish with this, a little bit of baseball. The offseason, Eduardo Rodriguez getting 5 years, $80 million from the Tigers today was one of the weirdest things I think I've ever seen. Not surprising. I'm a huge Yankees fan, and obviously the Mets GM search is kind of the two biggest things. Who do you see the Yankees kind of bringing in this offseason? It feels like it's going to be one of those offseasons, like the end of 2008, where Brian Cashman kind of just says, fuck it. And it's like, we're signing everybody. And then who do you think ends up as the Mets general manager? Because that's obviously a mess right now.
Yeah, I mean, there's a good chance by the end of the podcast, you might get an offer for the Mets general manager position, Will, to be honest with you. But from what I've read, it sounds like a former Yankees assistant general manager, former Angels general manager Billy Epler, has an offer on the table now. So we'll see. There's just something at the Mets. It's so strange because here's an owner, a new owner. He's obviously gone through a lot of troubles this past year. We all know that. First year as an owner, you don't want to make excuses for billionaires, but clearly a lot of things did not go well for the Mets this year, which is fine. But you would also think that general managers or aspiring general managers throughout Major League Baseball would want to jump at the bit to go to New York, play with the owner's money. He's not afraid to spend money, really build a team in their image. And it hasn't happened. Obviously, everybody's turning it down. So it sounds like Epler might get the job. I mean, he's a guy that's, again, he's not afraid to spend money, but the farm, what he does with the farm, and that might all fall on his shoulders as a GM, but what he's done with the farm isn't overly impressive either. So it kind of comes from that Cashman vein, and like prospects are out the door, like hug prospects until, you know, pump and dump kind of stuff. So very strange, very strange. On the Yankees end, they have to totally reimagine this team this offseason. I don't think there's any debate surrounding that, whether that's getting a Matt Olson for first base. I think that if he's on the table and you can spend a few prospects to get him, I think that's a slam dunk. No doubt about it. Home run. If not, then you bring back Rizzo, depends on the money, but Olson is younger. He's only going to cost you prospects. He's not going to cost you money. And we know that they're very tight with their money now. I think that that's a very smart, logical move for both sides to make. I also think that Corey Seager is a guy. I know Correa has the defensive metrics over Seager, but I also think that Correa, especially with his injuries in the past and the back, you know, when you have back problems that young in your career, it's never, never a good sign. And obviously he bounced back into a pretty big year this year. But Seager's a guy that he's still average defensively. He's not terrible defensively. He's a lefty bat. And, you know, if worse comes to worse, then you can move them over to third base, and then you can figure out shortstop in a few years' time. And they do have prospects who could potentially fill in at shortstop in a few years. So it's going to be a busy offseason for the Yankees. I mean, they have a lot of work to do. They really do. The rotation needs help. You can't go by with these lottery tickets anymore, trying to scratch off these lottery tickets, hoping that someone in the rotation works out. But the offense, they got to figure out something else offensively, because what they've been trying to do since 2017, it just hasn't worked. It hasn't worked. And I think Cashman has realized that.
I mean, I could not agree more. The guys I would like to not see back, Brett Gardner. I've been a anti-Brett Gardner. And it's nothing personal about, he's been a great Yankee, but he's about 4 years past being good. I would be frankly open to moving Gio Urshela. I think his value will never be higher than it is now. He's always hurt. He's very unathletic defensively. And while he makes great plays, it's a lot of times, it's that Derek Jeter method where, like, you are too slow to react, so you end up making a great play because you're not athletic enough defensively, obviously, to get there. And it's not a slight at Derek Jeter. It's just, if you watch the plays, like, that's literally why he was so bad defensively and in war. I would love to bring Matt Olson in. I think Rizzo is a guy that I'd bring back at a certain number, a three-year, $36 million deal, something in that nature. Maybe he's going to cost more. Another guy that's had back problems. And as good as Rizzo can be, I don't think he was – as good as he started off great and then got COVID and it kind of went downhill a little bit from there. It's going to be impossible to move Glaber. I don't know. You can't move off your youngest asset. Stanton and Judge are obviously stuck. I don't know what you do at catcher. Verlander's a name that I've seen floated. I'd be frankly interested in Verlander much more than a guy of a Kluber or a Tyone and people like that, where you're relying on Verlander's always been healthy minus this injury. So it's not like although he's older, he's a guy that just kind of, just always 200 innings, throws 96, 97, pumps up when he needs to. And then lastly, shortstop's just weird because Correa is like the anti-Yankee. Like, he's the biggest, you know, the guy that every Yankee fan hates the most, probably. I mean, I hate him more than Altuve. The Altuve stuff is frustrating, but Correa is obviously very outspoken. But at the same time, the Yankees can't be passing up good players because the fan base doesn't like them because they got, you know, he's that Johnny Damon type player where, like, he kills you all the time and you have to kind of bring him in. I'd prefer Seager. I just think lefty bat, I think he's a more kind of guy you could get around, but the Yankees aren't in position to be giving 10-year contracts out. They have to extend Judge. They're going to have to extend a lot of these different guys. And I don't know why they didn't extend Judge last offseason. His value wasn't quite as high, and you could have gotten away with, you know, potentially not running into this roadblock. And I guess we'll finish with one more baseball thing. A-Rod's up for the Hall of Fame soon. We got the David Ortiz stuff. We got a lot of the steroid guys. Some guys are going to be falling off the ballot soon if they do not get in. Where do you stand on the steroid guys getting the Hall of Fame? I personally think that they belong in. If they're a good enough player, you put them in, and that's it. The story of baseball is not written without guys like Bonds, Clemens, A-Rod, those players. Where do you stand on that, and how do you kind of fix some of the Hall of Fame stuff?
No, I'm with you. I'm with you there. Well, I really do, you know, and I flip-flopped with this a lot in recent years. And I think, honestly, it's kind of a generational thing too, because you see a lot of the older baseball writers saying, well, no way that this guy gets in. I just absolutely refuse. But then the younger baseball writers who, you know, will either have votes now or they'll have them in a few years are kind of more understanding to the situation and say to themselves, yeah, you can't write the story of baseball without a guy like Barry Bonds. You just can't. You can't. A guy like A-Rod, you know, like, you can't write the story of baseball without A-Rod. Like, you like him or not, like, he's part of the story, and he was a great player when he played. So I know that rubs a lot of people the wrong way, but cheating has been around. Performance enhancing drugs have been around for as long as the game has been around. There were rumors that Babe Ruth used to inject sheep testicles. So it's and I don't understand what that would do for you, but you know, that's the kind of stuff that's been happening around baseball for a long time. Now, is it going to get to a point where you say to yourself, well, yeah, just legalize steroids? I don't think that's ever going to be on the table, because, and I know people have mentioned that in the past, whether it's joking, you know, memeing or being serious about it, but it gets to a point where, like, well, you can't legalize it and then force a guy to take something that he doesn't want to take, period. Like, you just can't do that. So no, I think the steroid guys do belong in the Hall of Fame. You know, they deserve it. They were part of the game for so long. They kept baseball afloat in the 90s. Like, without steroids, who knows where baseball would be. And it's just, and I think that players now are smarter about it, or smarter in that they're not taking it, and they're not taking any kind of PEDs, and they're doing what they can. And performance science is so much smarter now than it even was 10 years ago. So it's just a different game all around. So yeah, I think the steroid guys do belong in. If I had a vote, you know, whenever A-Rod's up, I would vote for him. It's going to be interesting to see how it plays out, but I do believe those guys, they belong in.
Who is, I'm not an Aaron Boone guy. I can't stand the kind of the arrogance that comes with, you know, the Yankees have been cursed since he hit that home run in 2003, and there's nothing you can tell me that to change it. Who gets more heat? Who's the coach under the most heat in New York right now? Or the first guy that's going to, you know, people are going to start claiming for his job? Judge, obviously, with the Giants, they won last week, but has had a lot of issues this year. Salah's already under a lot of heat. Feels like Thibodeau and Nash are, they're in a good position. They're both going to make the playoffs. It's not a big deal. I'm not going to get into the hockey stuff because I can't talk as expertly about that, but feels like Boone, whoever the Mets hire, I mean, whoever, like, you know, the Mets, whatever happens to the Mets in 3 months. And then Salah and Judge, who's the first guy that gets under the most heat, you know, by the end of the year?
I think, well, you can't get any hotter than Aaron Boone can right now, honestly. And I personally was stunned that they gave him 3 years. Like, I didn't think for a second they would have gone beyond like two with an option, or like one with an option. I didn't think that was in the cards at all. So I think that this is existential philosophical thing, but so much of what, I don't think Yankee fans, obviously they hate Boone, but I think they hate what Boone represents more. I don't think they like this new era of manager, especially coming off a guy like Joe Girardi, who's like a field general, no nonsense, no BS kind of guy. And then you look at Aaron Boone, who's, you know, supposedly a puppet. You know, I don't think that that's the case at all. I think that there is true collaboration, but, you know, if someone tells you 2 + 2 = 4, you're not going to take that solution and say, well, actually, I think it equals 6. So that's really how the analytics in baseball works. So yeah, it's tough. I don't see, I mean, Judge is just about out the door at this point. There's really nothing short of them making the playoffs at this point. He's just uninspiring. There's just like nothing about him that really gets you going. He preaches discipline, and he's like one of these old school football guys who is just like, they say it's like, well, all of this, I'm sorry, my wife's in the background distracting me, but he's one of these like old school football guys that get the blowhards all hot and bothered. So I don't really think that he has a lot of staying power there. So I think Boone's like number one. If I had to guess, I'd say Judge is 1A, but him and Gettleman are going to be a package deal. They're both, if I had to guess, they'd both probably be out after the season.
Yeah, I'd be shocked if we get any three of the return of Garrett, Judge and Gettleman. I think the Giants are in, they're what the Jets were 12 months ago, but they're almost more in a better, they're in a worse spot because they have zero salary cap flexibility and have that additional first round pick. Chicago hasn't been quite bad enough that it's going to be a pick that, you know, maybe it'll be a good pick, but you know, the Giants, the Jets and Philly all are in a position right now where the top 15 in the draft. It's pretty much like eight of the 15 picks that are landing in those three spots. So eventually we'll get to the point where next time you come on, hopefully, you know, we won't have to talk about the draft and free agency and looking forward to 2022. But obviously appreciate, you know, coming on. Obviously follow Joe on Twitter, Joe Rivera SN again. And, you know, we'll, you know, hope for a nice W and rebound performance on Sunday from the Jets.
You got it, Will. Thank you so much for having me on, my friend. Really appreciate it.